Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, in large part because we once again get to talk about one of our favorite. I guess it's a set of documents. That would be the census.
Census. It is a set of documents. If they are printed, by the way, if you go into your local library and look at the printed sets, they are printed in such a way that there are volumes on population, there are volumes on housing, there are lots and lots and lots of math. And those things don't all come out at once. What Augie's going to talk to us about today is the newest release, but it gets released over like 2 or 3 years after the census is done. So the census is done on the O, on the zero number, right? So it was done in 2020 and it's starting to filter out now, and it will filter out for the next couple of years. And then the next census will be 2030. So it's always done on the zero.
Yeah. So the first set that got released, and Nia and I have already recorded a podcast episode about it. Okay, was the overall population numbers, and of course the Census Bureau has to get that out because that affects the representation in the House of Representatives.
Right, redistricting efforts.
Yeah, the redistricting efforts, right? And as we're seeing in real time, okay, those redistricting efforts.
That's not going as well as anybody would have hoped. Pretty much in the United States.
Okay. And again, in a previous podcast episode, which will be released before this one, okay, Nia and I
discussed that.
Yeah, we discussed that, right? Okay. Without going down that rabbit hole again, Nia and I, listeners, live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the state of Virginia. And the state of Virginia is one of those states that went with a commission to do redistricting and took it out of the hands of the state legislature, right?
Yeah, and our commission has done the total white flag of surrender. We can't make any of this work. We're about to be boarded by pirates. Oh my gosh, send help. Right? So,
yeah.
There are no maps for federal. There are no maps for the state. It's amazing the 100% level of failure that this commission has engaged in.
Yeah, because the first thing they raised the white flag on was redrawing the state legislative districts, right?
Right. And then they're like, the federal won't be nearly as bad.
Okay. When Virginia went with the commission, basically the failsafe in this process now is the state Supreme Court. So that went to the state Supreme Court. And as we are recording this episode, the commission co-chairs announced this week that more than likely they won't be able to get the congressional districts drawn. So that will more than likely go to the state Supreme Court.
Ah! Yeah, I'm thinking that, five kids with some Etch-A-Sketch could have done, but that's neither here nor there because that's not the census. So we got the original, like how many people live in the United States, sort of the big picture numbers in April-ish, right? March-ish, April-ish. And so this is a little bit of a deeper dive into sort of more race
and ethnicity. Okay. Yes. Yeah. This came out the week of August 9th. This set focuses on the racial and ethnic makeup of the U.S. population from the 2020 census, okay? And the big take, there are going to be a number of takeaways, but one of the first major takeaways when you look at what the Census Bureau released is that the diversity, it's referred to actually by demographers as the diversity explosion, is continuing, Nia, in the United States.
Now, okay? Just as a side note, when you fill out the census, you are asked to fill out your race from a list of things, and you can choose more than one.
Mm-hmm.
So for what we're talking about, there are people who have chosen non-Caucasian or Caucasian and something else.
Yes.
Right? When we refer to the, and I think you're going to get into this, these sort of the numbers as far as the white or Caucasian folk in the United States, that's people who have just checked the one box, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And more people are checking multiple boxes these days, right? More and more people are,
yes,
are recognizing their multi-heritage, multiracial background.
That is correct. So overall, okay, the United States had the slowest population growth in a decade since the 1930s.
We're not having babies.
Yes, okay. We're not having babies. Okay.
Of any race, we're not having.
Yeah, okay.
We're not having as many babies.
And we're going to touch upon impacts of these statistics later on in the episode. So overall, population growth in the United States was at the lowest amount since the 1930s, the lowest percentage, not amount, but percentage, okay, since the Great Depression, okay, since the Great Depression. I mean, and that should be pretty stark for our listeners, right? Because when we talk about the 1930s, okay, you're talking about the Great Depression, which then was followed up in the 1940s by World War II, okay? So you had major catastrophic events, okay, that interrupted, if you will, the normal life cycle, okay, of a nation's population. But in the United States, okay, what we saw with the 2020 census, if you will, depicts or demonstrates, okay, how Americans, as you just pointed out, Nia, are not having kids.
And that's according to your notes, 7.4% lower,
yes,
than any other decade. That's a lot. Like,
yes,
when you think about 7%, it's, you think, oh, well, 7%, that's not very much, but that's a lot of kids not being born.
Yes.
And that's a lot of people putting off or not having children at all.
Yeah. So as Nia also pointed out just a few moments ago, for the first time in our country's history, over 40% of the American population identifies as Latino or Hispanic, Black, Asian American, Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, Native American, or also reported two or more races. So what we're talking about here is, and this is the first time in our country's history, so is a majority of the population still Caucasian? Yes, but it is at the lowest amount in our country's history.
And that's what we, how much is the percentage of people who chose non-Caucasian or more than one?
Slightly over 40%.
That's
okay.
A lot.
Yes. Okay.
Is that going to lead us to that majority minority eventually? If that continues, if that growth rate continues, will the United States be no longer a majority white country?
According to most scholars whose research that I read in analyzing the August census, if you will, data, they are projecting that either 2030 or at the latest 2040, the United States will be a majority minority. Okay.
But even those folks are not having babies. Even non-white or people who have chosen more than one race are not having babies at high rates of numbers, right? If the overall population, one of those lies that gets told, which is that communities of color have lots of babies. Right. That's not necessarily the case. Nobody's having lots of babies.
The only community of color that is continuing to have babies is Latino and Hispanic. Okay.
At the same rate as previous. We don't mean not having babies, because obviously people are having.
They're having babies. But in terms of comparing percentages of 2010 to 2020.
Okay. Census.
Yeah. Okay. The only group that is consistently having children, okay,
at the same rate
or slightly higher, is Latino Hispanic.
Okay? Wow. Everybody else.
Every other group. Okay. Blacks. Okay. Asian Americans. Okay. Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders. Native Americans. Right. And of course,
and
Caucasians,
white folks, right?
Yeah, okay, are not having kids, okay? And what's even more troublesome for demographers is between 2010 and 2020, the nation's underage population actually registered a decline of more than 1 million. And why that is important is, again, folks, think about this. Those who are under the age of 18, okay, in a decade are going to be, okay, in the 18 to 25 age category or slightly older. And that's when they're supposed to be reaching their peak economic productivity, but also their peak
growth activity, right?
Yes. Okay.
Okay. So the decline leads to more decline, right?
Yes. So unless we get an infusion of young people, okay, from other sources,
other countries, unless we entice young people from other countries,
okay,
with money and supermodels,
okay,
of their choice to.
In terms of basic, if you will, demography, the likelihood is we're going to see a replication of that finding in 2030.
Okay.
Okay.
And in terms of, oh, wait, you want to talk about, or can we go ahead and leap into where that leads us?
Oh, sure.
No. It strikes me that means that group is also the group that pays for the medical care. The way Medicaid and Medicare are funded, working people pay for people who cannot work for whatever reason.
Yes.
They're too old or they're infirm and unable, right? And that's been our system for a long time. And unless we see reform in that system, we will have a smaller group of people trying to support a larger group of people. And we will see, I assume, cracks in the system at that point. Like there will be definite, that's definitely a hardcore burden on that population.
Yes. In listeners, what Nia is referring to is a phenomenon that has already occurred in other Western developed democracies. Okay. We've seen this in a number of Western European democratic nations. We certainly saw this with Japan in the 1980s and the 1990s. I mean, according to economists, one of the reasons why Japan's phenomenal economic growth of the 1970s and the early 1980s came to a screeching halt was they had this imbalance in terms of their population. Most Western democratic welfare systems, okay, you know, modern welfare systems, okay, the so-called safety net, are predicated on what, Nia, you just described. The systems, okay, the programs that generate benefits for the poor, for the elderly, okay, are paid for by taxes on people who are working. And if your population is getting older, like
not being replaced by people who are working,
okay, you have a basic, if you will, numbers
imbalance. Front. Yeah, you have an imbalance. Like, where's the money going to come from?
Okay.
So, do you think turn that around by encouraging people to have babies? Because I know in some countries they do that, right? In some countries they give incentives. I know we have some incentives because we have tax incentives and things like that. But there are also some countries where now, at least in Europe, they're starting to say, we will help you have a baby because we need the system to have a continuing population, at least replacement of what we currently have. Even if we're not growing, we need to replace so that we have a consistent population.
There have been some nations, okay, who have created programs to encourage people of, you know, childbearing years to have more kids. You know, one of the criticisms of the American system is that we don't do enough to help young people to have kids, okay? You know, think about, for instance, we don't have a program to go ahead and pay for, child care, okay?
Right. We don't have universal paternal and maternal leave.
That's right. Okay. We know historically that if a parent leaves the workforce to have kids and to raise them until they're ready to go to school, they are at a serious disadvantage compared to their peers. Okay.
Right. So if you want a career, it becomes a choice between career and kids.
And that usually impacts women because historically women, okay, were expected to raise the kids until they were, you know, school age. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there are some really difficult policy choices that the United States needs to make, right? Because if they're not going to give incentives for young people of childbearing years to have more kids, then we have to look to the other sources. We have to look to immigration. And right now, by all accounts, our immigration policy is a mess.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Well, but we may have to start. I mean, you know, that's an interesting thought question thing is, could we, so in some countries, the way they choose who gets to immigrate is based on skill set or based on education level or, you know, things like that. I wonder if at some point, some of the countries, us included, will start saying, we favor families. We favor young people who have two or three or four children in our immigration policies, instead of favoring for skills, favoring for birth rate.
Yeah.
Because that would be a relatively quick way to goose up your population is, or make it some combination, right? You can't just show up with 18 kids and, you know, have no skills whatsoever, right? Like, not like that, but some combination where you're favored not just for your intellectual gift or your skill set, but also your willingness and or already having
demonstrated children. Yeah, you know, demonstrated capacity
your fertility.
To go ahead and have kids. I mean, and I know for many listeners, that just sounds extremely,
Orwellian.
The Orwellian, crass, okay, bottom line focused. Okay, but again, we're talking about a safety net system,
right?
Okay, that has been the foundation of, you know, nearly a century, okay, of American political and policy life, okay. And if we don't do something to address that, okay, we're going to have some serious problems, right?
Right. I mean, if you set up a Ponzi scheme and you keep it going for 100 years, you got to keep it going for 100 more years.
That's right.
Or at least until you can set up something different. I mean, what we need is, a stopgap measure until we can change the safety net system.
I mean, to put this in context, listeners, right now, it takes 2.5 American workers paying taxes into the Social Security system to fund one person on Social Security.
2.5 I didn't realize it was that high.
Yes. Okay. I mean, when the system was initially created, it was 1-to-1. Then it was 1-to-1.5. Okay. Now it's 1-to-every 2.5 workers.
Wow.
And again, that reflects, okay, Americans until recently living longer, but you also have more people on Social Security who are entitled to the benefits of the program.
Right.
Okay.
And that's before a whole lot of the boomers retire.
Yes. Okay.
Which is going to be a demographic nightmare because they are a huge generation.
And many of them delayed their retirement because of the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. Okay.
But that's going to come soon, if not already. Right.
Yeah. The payment on that, if you will, on that check is going to come due. Okay.
Right.
We know this, right? And again, most scholarship that I've read is that by 2030, the United States Congress is going to have to make some fundamental choices about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, okay? Because those are entitlement programs. If you meet the criteria of the program, you're entitled to the benefits.
Right.
Okay. So unless we start cutting the benefits, and again, Nia and I have talked about this in previous podcast episodes, okay, all you got to do is take a look at the elderly in the United States and their expectations about Social Security to know that cutting Social Security benefits, okay, would be a political non-starter, okay?
Oh,
Nia and I both have parents, okay,
who get those benefits.
You want to go ahead and get them angry, okay? Go ahead and just, as you know, a thought experiment, say to them, hey, to make Social Security be solvent into 2040 or 2050, we're going to have to cut benefits, okay? I don't know about your parents, but my mom and my grandmother have both gone ahead and said, you know, John, if you continue to talk that way, we're going to cut you out of our wills. Okay. And they weren't really joking.
Yeah.
Okay. They weren't joking. Okay. So, I mean, that's why, for instance, you know, folks like Nia, me, and others, when the census, you know, starts releasing the follow-up reports, the deep dives, okay, the numbers tell a story, okay?
Right.
And the story of the 2020 census is, one, okay, the demographics of this country are changing, right? It may not be now, but by 2030 or 2040, a majority of the nation's population, okay, will be from communities of color. We know this, okay? Two, okay, the birth rate in the United States across almost every racial and ethnic category, with maybe the exception of, you know, Hispanics and Latinos, okay, has fallen so dramatically, okay, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. And it's not just government welfare programs. You need young people, okay, for economic productivity.
Right.
I mean, I hate to go ahead and say this, okay, but Nia and I are just a few short years, okay, from entering age groups that become more of a drain economically than we are contributors economically. Okay, but you know what I'm talking about,
I do know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And they do different kinds of jobs. Young people,
yes,
like at a certain age, it's really hard to be a nurse. It's really hard to be things where the physical labor of what you do is difficult, right? You see very few 80-year-old construction workers.
Yes.
Those jobs that are fundamental to a society are, you know, bus drivers. You can't drive a bus when you can't see anymore, right? Like,
yes.
There are things that we need young people to do that
you
that
can't stock shelves at
function.
Yeah, you can't stock shelves at a grocery store,
right?
Okay?
Or pull wood at a Lowe's.
Yeah. Okay.
When you're 80.
You can't. Okay.
Physically, you just can't do it. Well, most people. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger aside, who will apparently be able to lift cars when he's 80, but the rest of us have a physical slowdown that happens to you just because of aging. And, you know,
but also,
like I said, all of those really important jobs to keep society just functioning as a.
And then also think about innovation and creativity.
Right.
Okay. Again, we're not beating up on the elderly. It's just that historically, where you see innovation, creativity, okay, it comes from young people.
Right.
Okay. You know, young people who are like, okay, I don't accept that this is the way it should be done. Or, you know, I got this great invention and I'm willing to go ahead for the next 10 years, okay, to live on ramen noodles, okay, and coffee, okay, to make it work.
Right.
I mean, most of us, when we get into our 50s, we're like, we ain't living on ramen noodles and coffee, right?
I'll just stay in my job that I'm in rather than open up a new restaurant, a bookstore, a tchotchke shop, whatever it is.
Yes. Okay.
Those kinds of things are done by younger people most of the time. Not saying every old person is like that. So please, if you're an old person, we're not coming for you. It's just that most of that innovation is done by young people.
Yes.
Okay. And that's a good thing. Like that's the way society moves forward.
That's sustainability in terms of human population.
Right.
Right.
So when we don't have that, that's alarming.
Yeah. That's sustainability for a nation's economic system. Right. And that's why, you know, Nia and I would encourage you to take a deep dive into what was released by the census. Okay. In August, because it does tell a story about, okay, the demographic makeup of the United States. Okay.
Can I say a positive thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because right now we've been kind of negative. one of the good things that's coming out of this, I think, is that we're also having as a society a racial disparities reckoning right now. And in some ways, the shifting in the population will help take care of some of that naturally. Like there'll be fewer white people in charge of things because there will be fewer white people.
Yes.
And there will be more communities of color that will be more empowered because there will be more of them. They will be able to demand higher wages. They will be able to demand better living conditions, right? Like all the different things that have been caused over the years, in part by, and I'm not trying to be partisan or ugly here, but by benign white neglect. right?
Oh, sure. I mean,
some of that will actually get solved just by the sheer numbers of the people involved.
Well, I mean, and think about it in terms of, you know, democracy is frequently described as majority will.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're at a point now to where, okay, the majority is shrinking in terms of its whiteness, right? Okay.
Right.
Okay. So it's what
becoming
is
the less dominant part of the culture? It's becoming.
Yes. Right. I mean, so what is majority will, right? Okay.
So we'll see some really interesting changes in the next 10 to 20 years that are going to help, I think, with playing fields being more even.
Well, and for me, it would also seem to send a rather strong message to the various, if you will, racial and ethnic groups. If you want to achieve majority in the United States, okay, you're going to have to look outside of your what?
Your particular race.
Or ethnicity.
You're going to have to coalition build.
Yes.
Which okay. is something that until now, whites have not had to do in this country.
Whites haven't had to do it. And it really does go ahead and put a particular pressure point on identity politics.
And again, not to get too far into the weeds as far as politics of it are concerned, because I don't really want to go there with us, but I do want to note that does not absolve white culture of the things it has done to destroy other cultures.
Oh, no, no.
It doesn't absolve us of that. And I say us because Augie and I both identify as Caucasian, right? We as a group, there have been, you can look at lots of incidents over the years. You can see slavery and the Native American treatment and all kinds of things. It doesn't absolve us of that, but it does make the conversation far more balanced when more people have access to the conversation, which is, I think, what's one of the good things that's coming out of these demographic changes. I see that as a positive.
Oh, so do I. Okay.
And I hope I'm not just being Pollyanna and ridiculous, but I also see that as disempowering white supremacists.
Because at some point...
to paraphrase it, something out of the news show that Jeff Daniels did. If you're so gosh dang awesome, how can you lose so often? Right? It's... If whites are truly supreme, then their numbers wouldn't be dwindling,
okay.
Right? It wouldn't, I don't know. There's some real interesting questions there with what's going to happen to some of the more hardcore terrorist groups in the United States that are domestic.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a separate issue entirely. So
the other thing I wanted to go ahead and briefly touch upon, Nia.
Okay, and then yes. I have a question for you about COVID.
Okay, so if you look at the August census report, what's also fascinating is the in-migration, okay, in the United States, okay?
Which we talked about briefly last time about a whole bunch of people left from one place and went to another, and New York... It was like by 77 people that they lost a human, that they lost a representative.
Yeah, they lost a representative. But I mean, to me, what's fascinating is, okay, in the August report bears this out, okay? Americans, okay, by racial and ethnic groups are tending to move to where there are other people who look like them, right?
Really? So we're seeing more self-segregation?
Self-segregation. It is truly phenomenal, okay? And also other patterns that have been, you know, longstanding, okay, have continued. So for instance, you know, the decline in population in the Rust Belt states, right?
Well, there are no jobs.
Okay.
I mean, they have to go where there's tech jobs, where there's service jobs.
Okay.
But I'm assuming that it's further killing those areas. Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, it's just utterly fascinating. I mean, and I don't know why I focused on this because, you know, other than going to Las Vegas, you know, a handful of times. Okay. But, you know, I in the notes that I went and provided, Nevada's white population was 65% in 2000, 54% in 2010. It's now 46% in 2020. Okay.
Really? So communities of color are moving to Nevada?
Yeah. Okay. Because that's in part because of tourism jobs.
Oh, okay. Service industry job. I see.
White population in 381 out of the nation's 384 metropolitan areas declined.
So we're still seeing white flight then?
Oh my goodness, yes. Okay.
Apparently across the board.
Across the board. Okay.
So are they moving to suburbs? Is that?
Suburbs or rural areas. Okay.
And they're moving to where there are other white people.
Other white people, right?
Okay. I thought that was kind of a thing of the past, but apparently not. Okay.
Apparently not. Nia, 27 of the 100 largest metropolitan areas in this country, okay, are now minority white populations. Dallas, Orlando, Atlanta, Austin, New Orleans, Sacramento are minority white. Okay.
Huh.
Yes. Okay. I mean, it is just phenomenal. Okay. 35.
So do you think that eventually districting will come down not to political parties, but to race? Like eventually will districting have to take into account you have no communities of color in your district, or you have no white people in your district?
Well, I mean, it would absolutely flip that around, okay? Because, you know, the court has said, okay,
you can't do that.
You can't use race, okay? Right. Okay, for redistricting, right?
Right. Okay, but what if you need to do that in order to have diversity in your district?
Or to actually have white districts. I mean, again, if we get to a point where whites are no longer the majority, okay?
Oh, I see.
You see the...
Yeah, what are the Supremes going to do about that?
Oh, my goodness, right? You imagine the written briefs and the oral arguments on that type of case, Nia? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. That would be fascinating.
Okay. Hmm. But you wanted to ask me...
That brings up an interesting question about the courts and previous defense of minorities and how that has been a difficulty for minorities to say, wait, but we're a minority, we need to be protected. And the majority, which previous to now has been Caucasian, has said, you don't need to be protected. I don't know why you want special treatment. You're saying in 10 or 20 years, white people are going to be saying we need special treatment because we're a minority.
In certain voting districts. Yep, in certain voting districts. Yep.
Interesting. Okay, so my question about COVID is, COVID disproportionately affected communities of color in the sense that more people died in communities of color.
Yes.
I think, and not overall numbers. I mean, percentage-wise. The United States is still... The numbers of white people versus minorities are still larger, right? It's not that the percentage of population is changing, not the sheer numbers. There are still bunches and bunches of white people in the United States, and bunches of white people died during COVID. I'm not suggesting that they didn't, and that those losses are not important. No, they are. But
COVID-19 affected communities of color at a higher percentage than it did. White communities.
So okay. Will that push off the minority majority in some areas for a decade? Will that push it off from 2030 to 2040?
Yeah.
Or is it too soon to know?
I think it's too soon to know. I mean, when we have Dr. Judy Twigg back for a future episode to, kind of sort of get her to do a post-mortem on, COVID-19, that's probably a question that we could pose to her. I think right now it's a little too soon to tell.
Okay.
We just know that in terms of who COVID affected the most. You know, as you pointed out, yes, more white people were affected by COVID, but in terms of percentages within racial and ethnic categories, COVID affected communities of color at a higher percentage than it did Caucasian communities.
Right.
Okay.
Although in some ways, I guess it may not change because it also affected older.
Well,
older folks more than younger folks. So it may balance itself out. I see why you're saying we're going to have to wait.
Well, we're going to have to wait.
And probably a good 7 or 8 years to find out.
Yeah. I mean, because we don't know, for instance, okay, the extent to which contracting COVID but surviving, what it does to one's life expectancy. I mean, that's just, one variable right there, right? Okay. Let's say you contracted COVID, but you survived. But what does it do to your long-term life expectancy?
Mm.
Okay. I mean, we just...
you're one of those people who has, what is it, long haul?
Yes.
Long haul COVID, where you don't ever fully recover.
You don't fully recover, right?
Then okay. It probably won't be that kills you, but it will be a related thing like a pneumonia or a
your lungs have been so badly compromised that it is the next, infection you get or the next virus you get that attacks your lungs. Okay, that does you in. But
yeah, I can't remember if somebody was saying to me, you don't die from eating disorder. You don't die from anorexia. You die from a heart attack because your heart can't function anymore because it doesn't have what it needs to function. Some things don't kill you directly. They kill you indirectly by
indirectly.
The system in your body that allows that to happen.
I mean, because, there are already studies that demonstrate that those who suffered from anorexia or bulimia in their youth so badly weakened or damaged their heart that if they get any number of heart-related maladies when they get older, okay, their heart just can't fight off, okay, heart disease, okay, a heart attack, whatever the case may be, right?
Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad because you don't know that's going to happen until it happens.
It happens, right?
I have one other question about sort of the demographics.
Yeah.
So we know that young people like to actually live in the cities. Is part of the problem with city loss is that we don't have enough young people to fill in the gap where people are moving out into the suburb? Because if you ask young people, where do you want to live? They want to live near their jobs, near food, near their friends, near social activities like movie theaters and
entertainment options.
Right. Yeah. They want to do all that because, frankly, I wanted to do all that. When you're young, that's how you want to live, right? You don't want to live out in the suburbs where you have to drive 20 minutes to get to something fun. You want to be able to get out of your door
young,
and
you're
walk
curious.
Down the block. And, right. And,
yeah, you want to know what life has to offer, okay? Because, again, you're young, you're curious, you're energetic, okay?
So is a consequence of loss of young people causing losses in cities? Is that part of the problem as well, is that there aren't young people to infill?
I mean, again, if you look at the history of metropolitan or urban areas in the United States, okay, when they lose population, they lose tax base. When they lose tax base, okay, those who could afford to live in the cities frequently want to do what?
move out.
Okay. So this is a dangerous cycle, right?
Right. Because if we have no young people to infill, then there's nobody to build the tax base back to.
That's right. Okay. So, you know, this should be a warning sign, okay, for, you know, city governments. Okay.
Find a way to have affordable housing in your city for young people so that you can attract them into the city. And
affordable housing, good jobs, okay.
Public transportation. A lot of young people today would prefer to take.
Yeah, because they
are public transportation.
They are definitely, you know, a more environmentally conscious generation. Okay.
And yes. Cars are expensive. Like it's expensive to own a car, not just to buy it, but to maintenance it, to pay the insurance, yes, to do all that stuff. And if they're not making very much money, which is also one of the things that happens with young people, they're not making a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
So you need to keep that in mind when you're running a city. City planners and city managers, I suspect, are constantly trying to figure out how to attract young people to move back into the cities. The only other question I have for you is Texas. So apparently everybody is moving to Texas from California. Like Elon Musk just said, we're picking up and moving to Texas, right? Like he's got a whole thing. Elon Musk does not speak for the larger population. Please let me clarify that. I do understand that. But there does seem to be sort of this exodus of, and it seems to me a political thing. A lot of people whose politics, they're finding California politics to be too progressive, too liberal, too whatever for their liking, and so they're moving to Texas.
Well,
which seems to me like, wow, jumping from a frying pan to a fire. But
well, let's take a step back. From at least some of the surveys that I've read of, for instance, people moving from California to Texas, Wyoming, Montana, etc., it's not that they dislike the progressive politics. They don't like the cost. Just can't afford to live there. They can't afford to live there, right?
Okay. Oh, and Texas doesn't have state income tax, does it?
They don't have a state income tax, right?
Okay.
And if you look at the cost of living of any number of Mountain West states or Texas,
they're cheap.
Okay. Or even some deep South states. Okay, they are cheaper, but they do run into a culture shock when they move to those other states because the politics are not as progressive as they were in California. So what, you know, this gets tied to the concept of voting with your feet. If you move, if you vote with your feet, you should do a calculus as to what are the most important considerations, right?
I see. So you're saying that politics is a follow-on, not the lead. The lead is financial.
I think
the lead is that
the least the surveys,
I'm priced out of living here.
At least the surveys that I've read, have indicated that many of the respondents didn't have a problem with the progressive politics in the state of California, for instance, okay? What they had a problem with was the cost of living.
Okay. Which I'm sure Manhattan also suffers from.
Oh, hey, the state of New York is another classic example, right? I mean, think about, for instance, what happened to the New York City's population, in regards to the pandemic.
Right. People left I can do this from home, which means my home can be someplace significantly cheaper to live.
Cheaper. Yeah. Okay.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about, for instance, the number of conversations you and I've had off recording about opportunities that, you know, job opportunities we've had, for instance, in Northern Virginia or DC. Okay.
Right.
And one of our considerations is,
it's so expensive to live in
Nova. Yeah, right.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Sorry for those listeners outside of Virginia. It's called Nova, Northern Virginia, NOVA. So we call it Nova. And Nova is Alexandria, Fredericksburg, it's right around the DC area, except it's in Virginia instead of DC. And it is enormously expensive to live there. Apartment rents are high. Buying a house is unbelievably expensive.
Expensive, you know, and that's a consideration. So even if you like the politics of Northern Virginia local governments, okay, whether it be, you know, Alexandria, Arlington, okay, et cetera, okay, can you afford to live there?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So, I mean, in
so again, some of what people are leaving for is that it's cheaper.
Oh, sure.
When okay. I mean, part of it, you were saying they're also moving to where people like them look, right? Like
sure.
Who look like them are, them, is what I meant to say, sorry. But they're also doing that as an expense saving.
Yeah, so if economics is more important than political compatibility, okay, you might want, you know, you might be more willing to move from, for instance, California to Texas. On the other hand, if you move to Texas and you like progressive politics, okay, you're going to probably have a problem with statewide politics in Texas. But at the local level, you might enjoy actually living in Houston or Dallas, okay,
right,
which tends to be more liberal than the rest of the state, okay?
Do you think that the demographic changes that we see in the census this time, where people are moving to to where other folks like them, you know, who look like them, do you think that that outweighs the economic consideration?
Or that I don't. Yeah, I don't know that, Nia.
Or does there's not enough detail to find that yet?
I mean, what we do know from political science studies is that for probably the first time that we have been doing this kind of research, more Americans are picking where they live based on what they think will be ideological compatibility. And it's not just states. You have people who are picking, you know, what localities to live in.
I want to live in Hampton Roads versus I want to live in Norfolk because I prefer the...
Yeah, right. And in some cases,
okay,
you know, I work with people who pick communities in the Richmond metropolitan area based on what they think are the politics of that community.
Okay.
Okay. And you and I have family members, okay, who we know, okay, will, you know, they live in particular states and they live in particular parts of their states simply because they like the politics and the people who represent those politics in those communities, right?
Right.
I mean, you and I've talked about this, right? Okay.
So
that kind of self-segregation by politics, okay, is an increasing phenomenon in the United States. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So our takeaway from this August data dump, which is not the last and will not be the last time.
Oh no, we'll get stuff about
housing,
economics, health.
Yep. We'll get health statistics. And at some point we'll get a very tiny volume of leisure statistics. Because the United States doesn't really talk about its leisure life, and perhaps we should, because, you know, that would be but there is kind of a fun thing that happens there towards the end. And the other thing is we will get more detailed information on the various racial breakouts.
Yes.
That are held. We'll get full volumes on.
So for instance, the category of Black will be broken down by, you know, African-American, okay, you know, Jamaican,
Haitian,
Haitian, Caribbean, okay, you know, if you think about Asian-American, okay.
Right, which is a huge category and ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, there will be well over a
China
dozen.
And India, and you couldn't be more different.
I mean, Yeah, there will be well over a dozen subcategories, right?
So we'll get some cool volumes on those, and we'll come back to people and talk about that. But I think the takeaway here for folks is it takes a long time to parse this data. So there's a lot of stuff we won't know until demographers and social scientists get in there and really dig around in the data and start making comparisons, start making tables and all that other kind of stuff. What we're talking about is sort of the 50,000 foot view.
Yes.
In the next 3 to 5 years, what you'll start to see will be academic articles that actually talk about it in the 10 foot view, where you really do have a much, you can say a lot more about what these statistics mean.
Yes. Yes.
You can argue more about what these statistics mean. I wouldn't say that you can actually just say stuff, because it doesn't work that way, does it, Augie? Going to lend itself to political arguments, isn't it?
Well, I mean, think about this, Nia. You and I just spent, you know, an hour, okay, at the 50-foot level, okay? Imagine what we could do if we were, you know, the 50,000 foot level. You think what we would, you know, we could do if we were at the 500 foot level. Okay.
Right.
Okay. It is just fascinating. Okay. The level of analysis that will go into the more specific details. Right?
Agreed. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to put a link on the research guide to the census website. Don't be surprised if it takes you a little bit of digging to dig around on the site. Sometimes the census, they're not trying to hide information. It's just that there's so much information that sometimes it can be hard to locate exactly what you're looking for. But you can always reach out to me or Augie if you need any help with something. We can try to help you find the statistics that you're looking for, or hook you up with somebody who can.
In listeners, to Nia's point, you know, the little tidbit I gave about Nevada, I just like happened upon it. I wasn't looking for it, but all of a sudden I was just like,
there it is.
What's going on in Nevada? And I'm like, hey, wait a minute here.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're no longer a majority, you know, white population. How in the hell did that happen? Right.
That's the other thing that you have that's so fun with the census. The census to me is like Wikipedia. So you start by looking at one article, and then 2 hours later, you're looking at something completely different, and you're like, how did I get here? And now I'm thirsty and I need to go get a drink, right? Like, the census works that way for me too, where you're looking at something, you go, wait, why is that the case? And then you start digging in, and then pretty soon you're down a rabbit hole. So don't be surprised if that happens to you as well, because the census is a rich data set, and there, as much data as in there, you will find hours and hours of interesting stuff to look at.
Yes, I
would
agree.
We will come back with more cool volumes as we get them.
Yep.
And otherwise, thanks so much, Augie. This is really interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It is a geek's delight.
Yes.
Okay.
You policy wonk, you. You got this one, because you're so...
Oh, I love this stuff.
More census stuff came out. You know, how often do your friends say to you something with that sort of excitement in their voice that doesn't involve tickets to an awesome concert or whatever?
Well, I mean, it's kind of sort of like my friends will go ahead and say, you know, we basically leave Augie alone in June because that's when the Supreme Court issues all of its important rulings. And I'm just like, No, don't leave me alone. I can't wait to go ahead and share this. And they're like, No, we can wait.
we're good. You tell it to Nia. Tell it to Nia and the podcast. See, they're probably really relieved that now you have a podcast and you can do that.
Yeah, because they're just kind of sort of like, you know, hey, you know, you've already talked yourself out by talking to Nia on the podcast, right? You know, give us the abridged version, would you please?
Which, by the by, we will be seeing some interesting Supreme Court
stuff
coming.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because they've got themselves lined up, so we've got some interesting.
Yeah, their docket for the 2021-2022 term, okay, is probably Chief Justice John Roberts' worst nightmare.
Yeah, and we'll be here to enjoy it.
All right, Nia, have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
All right.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.